I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Okay, so I come from a serious fish-loving family. I mean, it's just sort of our heritage. Like, Cantonese Chinese people are among the seafood-lovingest people on Earth. But honestly, I used to almost never cook seafood at home. And I know I'm not alone in that, because market studies show that almost 75% of all fish eaten in the United States is prepared in restaurants. And there just aren't a whole lot of Americans who really cook fish at home. But something changed for me recently. You know, I made shrimp the other night, I made fish the night before, and so I started buying frozen fish at the grocery store. At first it was a little bit out of like desperation for some variety in the pandemic, but you know what? Like, it's really pretty good. And turns out, again, I'm not alone. Because recently I read a story in Bloomberg Businessweek that retail seafood sales have gone up 40% during the pandemic. So with all these new people cooking fish at home, we wanted to spend a show talking about how to shop and how to cook all that real-world seafood. You know, stuff you can get at the grocery store, not, you know, the GoldenEye snapper flown in overnight from Tokyo. We're going to start with Jennifer Bushman. She's a marketing consultant obsessed with bringing seafood and seafood sustainability into people's lives. She has a project she calls Sea Pantry that's all about teaching people how to stock up and use different kinds of seafood. And she's here to talk about how to shop for fish in a grocery store near you. Hey, Jennifer, it's great to have you.
I am so excited to be here, Francis. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much. So I want to start with this really kind of amazing statistic. And that is that like almost 75% of all the fish and seafood that we eat in America is actually prepared and eaten outside the home. So like 3/4 of the seafood we eat, we're not actually cooking or, you know, even stirring up the tuna salad for ourselves, right? And I mean, that's really kind of amazing. I'm sure there are studies done on why that's the case. But one thing I guess I would assume as a factor is that, you know, chefs who we as a culture have looked up to tell us how to cook our food for the last 20 years, you know, always talking about, you know, when you're cooking fish, you're cooking seafood, you know, you go to your local fishmonger and you develop a great relationship with them and you find out what's coming in like right off the boat to them. And that's what you got to cook, like the most pristine fish. And it's like, look, no one does that, right? Like no one has that person in their neighborhood. No one has that relationship. And they're not talking about the grocery store, right? So let me ask you this first. Why does grocery store fish have such a bad rap?
You know, I'm not sure. I think I would probably dial it back even further. And that's the fact that, you know, chicken is really easy. We're very familiar with how that tastes, how to cook it. Same would be true about a hamburger or a steak or even a pork chop, right? So that all looks familiar. But even at the grocery store, when you've got 20 or 30 species of different fish, I think that it was overwhelming. And I think that the additional expense of it and the fact that we were intimidated to cook it and that it smelled the house up, like people didn't like actually living with that fish dinner after they made it, those were statistically the barriers to entry. So during the pandemic, we still craved fish and seafood, but we weren't comfortable going out to restaurants. If we were getting it from takeout and delivery, it wasn't as good as we wanted it to be because fish and seafood maybe was thought of as not traveling well. And so now all of a sudden, bringing it home and really getting over that barrier was the only way we had. And so, you know, we know that fish and seafood sales and retail went up over 40% in some cases. So we had to get over it. And that was a great moment for all of us that love fish and seafood.
Yeah. But let me ask you, like, would you say that the quality of fish you can get in a grocery store is good, bad, has gotten better? Like, tell, you know, sort of break us out of this mold of like, oh, you have to go to a local fishmonger to get fish that came right off the boat.
Yeah, I mean, I think that everyone has grocery stores now. I love that sort of specialty category of grocer. Maybe it's owned by a family locally. There are lots of examples of them in every single city in the United States where it may not be all of your shopping, but that are carrying healthy, fresh, sustainable, delicious seafood. It's mm-hmm. not just the larger natural grocers of the world. Now, you could argue that some of the commodity grocers, maybe even some of the club stores, might be an issue. Maybe they're selling things that were frozen that weren't thawed properly. But I can tell you there's a lot of hope around the quality and a lot of hope around the sourcing. And it just takes one little Google search to your grocer to see what their sustainability policies are in fish and seafood. And I think that you would easily be able to feel more comfortable.
Okay. And you mentioned the idea that, you know, some stores might be selling previously frozen fish that wasn't thawed well. And I think like frozen fish, like that has definitely got a bad rap. But I don't know. I started buying frozen fish in a grocery store during the pandemic because that was what was available. And I have been very pleasantly surprised. It's been pretty good. Did something change or did I just always have a misperception?
Well, I think things changed for sure. You know, fish, as we were relying on more wild captured fish, their fish was in season. And what would happen is grocers would buy lots and lots of that fish. And then what didn't sell, so you'd see the price go down and we'd all buy it when it was in season, so excited. And then they would take the remaining and throw it in the freezer. That's not ideally how we want to freeze fish. And so what's happened is the freezing technology has gotten so good that really frozen is the new fresh. And we have our friends in Alaska to credit for that. There's been some incredible work, Francis, by Google, by a subsidiary of Google that's been working on freezing technology.
Wait, literally
technology.
By Google? Like,
yes.
Google is learning how to freeze fish.
And the reason why was because they made a decision that on their campuses, they did not want to outsource fish that and seafood that had been flown in, that the carbon footprint was too high. So if they couldn't get a local fish that was less than 150-mile radius from the campus, it had to be brought in frozen, because bringing frozen in on container ships is a much lower carbon footprint and more sustainable for the environment.
Oh, that's fascinating. So tell me what Google did to improve the quality of frozen fish.
Well, they went right to the mothership, to Japan, and they started working with suppliers, farmers there, because aquaculture is also one of the important solutions to what we're doing, buying farmed fish that's sustainable as well as properly caught wild fish. And they started working there. And it was both on the equipment side, but it was also on how they froze it, what the temperature was, and how they packed it. So what we call individually quick frozen packages. And then they trained the chefs that were working with it on how to thaw it. Because the idea of throwing it into a tepid bowl of water and thawing the fish too fast is also part of the issue of it being mushy or tasting dry and watery when you cook it.
Okay, so I'm guilty of thawing my fish that way. there's so much I want to dig into. First of all, I'm fascinated by how different ways of freezing fish keeps a higher level of quality. Maybe we'll start there and then I'll get into how should we properly thaw. But let's get from, the fish is coming out of the water.
Yes.
Tell us about what new freezing technology is or what it does, why it's better than what we used to have.
So think about a fish, right? In variable temperatures of water. Obviously, you don't go boating by and see a fish frozen solid in a pond, right? I mean, they're able to survive. And fish muscle has sort of a natural antifreeze in it. So what they did was, first and foremost, it's frozen at an enormously low temperature as fast as possible. There is some fish and seafood that gets glazed first. We have found that if you have a small little spray of water over the top, that what it does is it actually creates a seal or a bond between the cold air and the muscle itself. The other thing was the packaging, making sure that the packaging had no air in it, so vacuum sealed packaging. And then when they actually freeze it, it goes into a solution of water and alcohol, so the temperature is even that much lower, so that then it freezes fast, Francis, because the goal is not to allow the muscle and the water that's in that fish to expand. Because that's what happens to water when it's frozen, is it expands and tears the muscle. So you need to freeze it quickly so that the water doesn't expand and the muscle doesn't tear. And then from there, then when you thaw it, if you thaw it slowly in the refrigerator or in ice cold water, you bring it slowly up to temperature, then you don't get that tearing and contracting of the muscle. And in taste tests, honestly, chefs can't tell the difference. Frozen really is the new fresh.
Oh, that's amazing.
And you have to think, too, about cooking method. So if I'm steaming a piece of sole, a very delicate fish, I'm probably going to make a decision to buy a fresh piece of sole for that, right? Because that, in a steaming method, we're really relying on what is going to be the flavor of the fish and that natural water that's in it, right? We don't want to have the structure change. Where if I had a piece of frozen cod and I was making fish and chips, it'd be fantastic. Right? So it's really looking at the type of fish. Tuna freezes beautifully because it's a muscle that's very firm, almost like a filet mignon. So we think about what are the different ways in which we're going to cook the fish. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why I started Sea Pantry, because I thought there are going to be these incredible items of the sea in our cabinets to get us cooking more fish and seafood. The refrigerator acts as a pantry for that, with fish that we're going to eat within a couple of days. The freezer are the things we can keep for up to a year. Good frozen fish keeps for a year in your freezer. And then you have all of the tinned seafood and the conservas, beautiful canned lobster and things like that, that can be on hand to make a quick pasta out of right out of your cabinets.
Okay, you just used a word I'm not really familiar with, and that's conservas. What is conservas?
So conservas is the artistry of a tinned seafood. So, you know, in the United States, we have primarily eaten tuna fish, right? Canned tuna. In fact, it is one of the number one fish that we eat. That and shrimp makes up almost half of the total amount of fish and seafood we eat in the U.S.
a
year. No.
Canned tuna and shrimp is half of the seafood Americans eat.
Nearly.
Wow.
Yes. So now, just like how there are beautiful olive oils and beautiful wines tracing back, you know, 100 years to these beautiful Portuguese port towns in Spain, and now even here in the U.S., the art of canning different types of fish, seafood, and shellfish is known as the art of conservas. You have a restaurant there in New York called Maiden Lane, and the entire restaurant menu is conservas, these artisanal, canned, beautiful seafoods. And I'm in love with them. They're not overly fishy. You can get some that are like little cockles or beautiful lobster, still reasonably priced, and they can make a quick pasta, a delicious dinner without anything but just topping it after you get the pasta and the pesto done.
That's seafood industry expert Jennifer Bushman, and we'll be back with more in a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Hey, so we're spending this episode talking about seafood, how to shop for it in the real world, and how to cook it. We've been talking with Jennifer Bushman, an absolute font of knowledge, about how to find good stuff even in a regular old grocery store. Let's get back to her. Okay, so when I think of canned seafood, I usually, you know, obviously think of tuna, or I think of canned salmon. For whatever reason, my family was really into canned salmon when I was a kid. But when you say, you know, things like canned lobster, other seafood that we really only think of generally eating fresh, what's the texture of that like? Is that, am I going to open that up and be like, oh, wow, this is just like fresh? Or is it a different product and I would just enjoy it in a different way?
Well, I mean, I think that we can come up with beautiful recipes from canned clams, for example. So think of the texture there. It is really to finish a dish with, just to warm it through. If you were to make your linguine and clam sauce and really let those canned clams simmer in the butter and the parsley, they would get chewy, right? So I'm always really careful. Lobster is very similar. Depending on, remember, they add other flavoring sometimes and ingredients. There's preserved lemon. In Spanish service, there'll be beautiful smoked paprika and olive oil, you know, all kinds of great things added to it. And what I find is that I finish dishes with it. And then the ones that are on their own, like a canned steelhead trout or something like that, then I might add a grainy mustard or think about building layers of flavor into whatever I'm using it for. But the textures really are delicious, and they don't require any sort of rinsing or anything like that. They just go straight from the can into the dish.
Wow. So like if I'm making a pasta, you make the sauce, and instead of cooking the seafood in with it, you just add it at the end, and it's part of the dish. It's not like a finishing in like a little, you know, sprinkle of herb on top, but meaning you're just not cooking it very heavily.
That's 100% exactly right. So if I had a beautiful pasta, I love these kelp pastas, pesto sauce, maybe you've used all your leftover lettuces and herbs, whoosh that up in the blender, toss it all together. And then what I would do is just in the warmth of the pasta, in the warmth of the sauce, I would toss in those tinned seafoods and then serve it with that sprinkling of parsley or something on the top. So it's not that I'm layering it on the top. I am starting to incorporate it in the same way that we might add arugula to a bowl of pasta and sort of toss it in and let it lightly wilt prior to it being served.
Yeah. Would you use the oil? I mean, often these tinned seafoods come in oil, right? Do you use that oil? Do you drain the oil?
I love using the oil. I think it's a great question, but that's where you're going to get a more pungent flavor. So don't add it all at once. I would say take the seafood out. You sort of just spoon it over the pasta. And then if you found you wanted a little bit more robust flavor, then I would start to spoon the oil over. Because especially when you get into these, what we call feeder fish that are very high in omega-3s, the anchovies, the sardines, the mackerel, those are going to have much stronger flavor, and you're probably going to use those more sparingly. You can always add, but you can't take away.
Sure. And if you're shopping for this stuff, like how do you know what's great and what's good and what's, you know, oh, this is the stuff that falls into that bad rap category?
I think that you want to look for eco labels. So if I was buying a traditional can of tuna now, kind of the base foundation is that we say it should be dolphin safe, right? That we don't want big nets scooping up tuna in a fishery that is depleted. And fair trade is a good place to start. Things like the Marine Stewardship Council's blue fish on the side of the can. It's this blue with a little white fish in the middle. That's a good place to start. The Aquaculture Stewardship Council, which is a green check. Those are good places to start. And I would say, you know, to be honest, these are not going to be a 99-cent can of fish. But what I would say is explore these fantastic things. And maybe you'll find one you love. Maybe someday you'll find one you don't love. But it's the exploration that's also part of the fun.
Yeah. Let's go back to frozen fish for a second. Okay, so now you have this beautiful frozen fish. How do you handle it when you get home? Because earlier I confessed to you that I do take the frozen fish that I now buy and I just kind of, you know, I forgot what else I get for dinner, or like I look up and oh my God, it's 5 o'clock. So I grab, you know, the filet, it's in its little vacuum sealed cryovac bag, and I chuck it into a bowl of warm water because I figure, well, I'm going to cook it anyway. So if I just bring it up to room temp in the warm water, that should be fine. But that is a mistake. Like I should not be doing that.
I mean, you know, depending on the filet, it's going to thaw relatively quickly anyway. Mm-hmm. So I would say take a deep breath, put it into the ice water and let it come up. You could also sort of run it yourself under the cool faucet and it will start to thaw. And I think you should know that the faster that you're thawing it, the lesser the quality will be. But there are still some ways that you can fix it. So it depends on how you're cooking it.
Sometimes though, I'll see, like sometimes you get like a side of salmon where the whole thing is cryovac'd, but it will say, do not thaw in this packaging. So what do you do then? And why?
Well, you've got to follow the instructions because there are different types of film. One of the things that I'm so excited about is something called a 10K OTR bag, where the fish actually breathes and gets oxygenated. I know. These are the things my husband hears about across the dinner table. But they're antimicrobial films that mean they actually are safer, and they're very good for packaging different types of proteins. They also are recyclable. We're trying in every way that we can to eliminate things like styrofoam and plastics from fish and seafood production. If it says not to thaw it there, then putting it on a tray in the refrigerator, you can loosely cover it with whatever. I like to use beeswax. I'm sure that you've seen the new bees wrap that, you know, is sustainable. I'll use that and just layer it over the top because it can dry out in the air of the refrigerator. So thawing it that way is going to be your only option. You don't want to be thawing it a filet by itself in the water. water for the very reason that the fish is going to absorb so much water. But primarily, those companies that are more sustainable, you are going to see packaged seafood in 10K OTR bags where you can count on the fact that it'll get longer shelf life and you can thaw it in the film.
Oh, wow.
Then, you know, usually it's wet and you don't want to cook it if it's wet. You want to make sure that you take a paper towel and you really dry it off well.
This is after you've thawed it, yeah.
Yeah, after you've thawed it, sorry. Okay. And then depending on how you're going to cook it, you can sort of do some tricks like a dusting of rice flour because it helps absorb moisture. So if you were sauteing it in a pan, you'd get a gorgeous crust on it just by using a little seasoned rice flour. And that would also help the crispness of the texture and absorb some of that water. The other thing that most people don't know is fish sticks to surfaces that are too cool. And mm-hmm. one of the issues that we have with a fish that maybe has not been thawed properly or has more water in it is oftentimes if you get it in the pan and then you see all of that water run out of it, you're essentially steaming the fish at that point instead of actually sauteing it. So what I would recommend is make sure that you get the grill or the pan nice and hot, then put a little bit of oil over the fish, and then get it in that pan and get it nicely seared. And that searing then will move those juices from the outside of the fish to the center, and it'll cook relatively quickly without it getting that mushy texture. So you can fix it. But the thing to remember is fish sticks to surfaces that are too cool, so get them nice and hot. And this is going to be, you know, in that 425 range, 450. And then the other thing is just make sure you don't keep turning it. You get it nice and golden brown, turn it once, and you'll end up with something that is really crisp on the outside and moist on the inside. And we do tend to overcook our fish. So I would say try to get used to leaving a little room on the doneness side so that when it's been subject to that carryover cooking, it doesn't get overly done, because a frozen fish like a cod will taste overdone very quickly. It can taste dry, even though it's a relatively moist fish.
Okay, so like undercook it slightly, give yourself a little bit more room for error also.
Exactly. But isn't it exciting that there are all of these things that we can bring home, different species, ways in which we can find a way to trace it to the boat or trace it to the farmer? We really do have so many options at this point to bring different types of fish and seafood. And we can't forget about seaweed and kelps that are so significantly important to our environment that we can start to bring into our pantries to cook every day.
Yeah. And it's incredible that people are starting to play with this more at home. So it's great to have you. Thanks so much, Jen.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can find out more about Jennifer Bushman's work and her sea pantry idea at jenniferbushman.com. And she shared with us a recipe for tinned scallops and kelp pasta. You can find it at splendidtable.org. Genevieve Coe is a prose pro in the food writing world. She has co-written over a dozen cookbooks. She's been an editor at 6 different magazines, and most recently, she was the cooking editor at the LA Times, and now she's come back to the East Coast, and she is a senior editor at New York Times Cooking. If there's a thing you can eat, she has bought it, she has created a recipe for it, and she's probably gotten you to make it too. So I wanted to talk with Genevieve about how she would handle just regular old seafood. Hey, Genevieve.
Hi, Francis.
It's so great to talk with you. So I know we both grew up in Cantonese households, so I want to know if this sounds familiar to you, right? Because my family was almost religious about our fish. We always bought it fresh from a fish store. It always came whole, and we always ate it that night. And, you know, we would never keep fish leftovers. Yeah. Like, you would have to eat until you fell out of your chair before we would keep fish overnight.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, does that sound familiar? Is that like how you grew up?
Absolutely. We only had whole fish and they weren't even gutted. We gutted them at home and actually probably bought it around 4 p.m. from the market and then had dinner at 6. And we would never keep it till the next day. We would just buy it that afternoon, eat it that night.
You were the only family more maniacal about this than we were.
I'm pretty sure there are a lot of other families out there who did the same.
That's fair. I mean, this is a very, like, coastal Chinese vibe, and I'm sure many other coastal cultures as well. But okay, so so we grew up in the same sort of way when it came to fish. So I have to say, for me, it was really kind of a leap to start cooking frozen fish. But you know, when you're developing recipes for your audience, I'm assuming you're doing it with seafood that's like more widely available, that didn't have to be bought 2 hours before you cook it. You know, it's seafood that's more in the good category than in the, you know, super obsessive category.
Sure, absolutely. You know, the big difference is having to apply to it a lot more flavor and texture. So the fish is still great. But, you know, when you have fish that's pristine just in and of itself, that's why so often the fish I had growing up was just steamed. Right, because you just want the flavor of the fish. Or for, again, for people who are fishing, they just give it a quick turn in a pan with nothing more than maybe a little salt and pepper. Mm-hmm. But if you're dealing with fish that you're not quite sure how long it's been at that fish counter at the supermarket, and maybe you aren't even cooking it that same night, basically you just want to give it lots of big flavors and textures so that whatever you end up making will be super delicious. So I think one of the main things that I suggest is for sure things with really flavorful stew bases, caramelized onions or other alliums like scallions or shallots, or and certainly lots of garlic. You can add in peppers for sweetness, tomatoes for sweetness. You can add in any sort of broth that has a lot of flavor. You can add a splash of wine, but you actually want to get the stew going first. You want to get all those flavors really intensified first, and then you add the fish just at the very end, and it cooks so quickly, just in minutes. So you can actually cut the fish in chunks and add it that way, but you can also add the whole fillets, and they'll just sort of naturally flake apart if you're using, say, a flaky white fish.
So what are some like specific dishes that that you've enjoyed making lately?
Sure. So one is actually from one of my colleagues at NYT Cooking, Yowande Komolafe. She
just developed her.
Yeah, she's awesome. Amazing. And she's great at building flavors. And she did a stew called moqueca, which comes from Bahia, a state in Brazil that has tons of fresh seafood on its coast. And so, of course, this stew is the most delicious if you can get that sort of seafood. But I made it with supermarket fish, and it was so phenomenal. So she does start with that base of onions and peppers and tomatoes. But one ingredient she adds that's unique to Brazil and you can find in supermarkets, you can order online, is red palm oil. And that oil in and of itself has a really delicious, rich flavor. And especially when you're adding fish, it actually brings a richness, right? So she calls for cod, but any lean, flaky white fish will do. And that added richness is something that makes the stew so delicious. But another trick that she used in that dish that makes it so tasty is that she actually tosses the fish with lime juice and salt and lets it sit for a while it's while the rest of this stew is developing its flavors. And bit of acid and salt in that fish, that's a trick you can apply to any sort of stew, giving it that chance to get some great acid and salt into the fish even before it starts cooking. That actually makes a big difference too.
Yeah, it's like I will often salt fish or like simple proteins like that. Like I'll salt them or season them, maybe like with some, you know, depending on the flavor of the dish, maybe with some soy sauce or some fish sauce or something like that. Like not really marinating it even, but just kind of like pre-seasoning it for, you know, 10 minutes or whatever before it goes in. But tell me about adding lime to the fish there, because, I mean, does the lime start to cook the fish like a ceviche, or, you know, what is it?
Right.
Is it just purely for flavor, or what does that do in there?
Yeah, it does start to change the protein structure. I know a lot of people debate, well, is it technically cooking the fish? Well, regardless, it does start to actually change the proteins in the fish. So when you do that, it does only take a couple of minutes to finish cooking once it's in the simmering liquid. Whereas if you were just throwing in fish that maybe you just seasoned with a little salt right before, it would take a few minutes longer. But it both changes the protein structure to make the fish a little more firm, a little more toothsome, which is really nice. But it also does have that acid. And it's nice because you have this acid that sort of transforms the fish, and you cook it and it sort of gives it a mellower citrus taste. And once you're finished with the dish, you can add another fresh squeeze of lime juice and you get that other bright, bright citrus taste from it. And so you actually get both ends of that in that one dish.
That's cool.
Yeah. But also like, Korean style stews with kimchi, like a kimchi jjigae, like those sorts of flavors are so great for any seafood. And I know one of my friend's moms taught me that when she first came here to the U.S. and didn't have access to the seafood she was used to, she often would use canned seafood in her soups, and, you know, in addition to fish that came from the frozen aisle. But she just built up so much flavor in the soup base to begin with. And there you're not caramelizing the onions, but she would simmer the onions with the stock and use actually dried fish as well to bring flavor to the soup base even before she added the fresh and or canned seafood.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking to New York Times Cooking Senior Editor Genevieve Koh, and we'll be back with more and your questions in a minute. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're back with Genevieve Koh, recipe developer extraordinaire, patron saint of home cooks everywhere, and we are talking about cooking seafood out here in the real world of grocery store seafood counters and frozen fish aisles. Let's get back to it. Something I have been cooking a lot is shrimp, and I honestly, I just buy my shrimp frozen. I just pluck it out of the freezer aisle. In my local store, I can actually find wild Gulf shrimp, which I love to support fishery in the Gulf of Mexico. But are there things that you, how do you like to treat something like frozen shrimp? And do you have ideas for how to use it?
Yeah, absolutely. So shrimp, I actually usually buy and keep frozen in the freezer as well, because it's such a convenient thing to have in there.
Totally.
And you know, what I do is I actually will take as much as I want to cook, and I like to defrost by just running it under cold water in a colander. And it usually only takes like 5 minutes. I guess it depends on how big they are. And a trick that my mom taught me is after I shell and devein the fish, or sometimes I actually also use shrimp that's already been shelled and deveined, sprinkle it with a little salt and toss it in the colander and just let it sit there a little bit longer, you know, just a few minutes, rinse it off again, and then pat it really dry. And that's a technique that she would always use, both for shrimp that we would end up steaming or stir frying, because what it gives the shrimp is this nice, snappy, crunchy texture. And of course, it does give it a little bit of flavor as well. But shrimp is pretty naturally salty, so you don't actually want to like coat it in salt. You just want to give it a light sprinkle. But it helps draw out some of the excess water. The shrimp holds some water, obviously, both just naturally, but also from being frozen. And that just helps tighten its texture. And, you know, and again, if you're stir frying it, searing it, anywhere where you want it to be tossed with hot oil in some way, I do just make sure I dry it really well right beforehand so that it doesn't pop when it hits the pan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I like the brine shrimp.
That's amazing.
And I realized at some point, if I'm brining it, why don't I just throw it in frozen into the brine? And by the time it defrosts, it's kind of already brined.
Oh, my God. Genius. Oh, Francis, I'm probably going to start doing that. Brilliant.
It's like, well, if I'm defrosting it, I might as well just put it in something that's going to give it flavor, too.
Oh, that is so smart.
I just start that, and then I prep something else. And, you know, I don't do a super salty brine, like probably just shy of like ocean salty, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
With some sugar to balance. You know, I just toss it into, you know, a saute, or I'll toss it into a stew, like you said, like at the end. So it just cooks for literally 90 seconds, you know, and then it's done.
Yeah,
it's perfectly
so
cooked and the flavors are
it's so quick.
It's super great.
And I think frozen shrimp even works well for just poaching. And I always like to throw in like a squeezed in lemon with its rind and maybe some bay leaves or herbs. And when I do my like technique of drying out that water and poach the shrimp, it does develop a really tasty snap in its texture that I think is great for shrimp cocktail. Like I'm a big fan of just good old shrimp cocktail sauce. Sometimes do that as well. Yeah.
It's so funny because shrimp cocktail to me still feels like, oh, this is classy.
Right? I know. It's a nice thing that I found. It's like a fun, nice thing to do at home every once in a while, especially this past year, to just be like, ooh, here's something special that actually requires almost no effort.
Right on. Well, you know, we have had so many callers send us their questions about cooking fish and seafood. So I want to pick your brain on some of these.
Yeah.
All right. So let's start in Canada.
I'm Francesca calling from Mississauga, Ontario. I need ideas for fish my kid might try other than fish sticks or drenched in lemon and butter. Thanks.
So this, I love a fish stick. I gotta be honest with you.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I love them. They totally taste like childhood. I love that flavor. But okay, so if she wants to get her kid to try seafood on their fish sticks, what would you say?
Sure. I think, you know, the whole appeal of fish sticks, you know, is that crunchy outside. So if you want to do fresh fish and still offer that crunch without deep frying, what I've done for my kids is I actually will slather the fish with a thin layer of mayonnaise or some sort of mayo-based sauce, so like mayonnaise and mustard or even tartar sauce, you know, or mayonnaise, yeah, mixed with like finely chopped pickles if your kid's into that sort of thing.
And directly then, on the fish, like the raw fish.
Yep. Well, I'll season the fish with a little salt and then spread that on the fish, coat it with any type of crumbs, so panko crumbs, crushed up potato chips, even like some snacks. Sometimes I'll crack them into tiny little crumbs. And
Cheetos.
Then throw
just
that
say,
on top.
Just say Cheetos.
I was trying to be classy here. But I was going to say, I do sometimes like all varieties of chips, but even just breadcrumbs work.
Okay.
And even better if, you know, you toss them in a little bit of oil or melted butter, throw that under the broiler. And I'll be honest, for a weeknight meal, by broiler, I mean, I use my toaster oven broiler because it just heats
totally
it even faster.
Same.
Yeah, it all fits in there. And once you have that crunchy fish, like some kids will be happy to just eat a fillet of crunchy fish like that, but that's something you can absolutely slide between some squishy burger buns, you know, with a slice of cheese if you want for like a fillet of fish-like sandwich or whatever else your kid might eat on that sandwich, a little lettuce or tomato, of course. But I also will do that treatment for, you know, a version of fish tacos, right? That's not like a real fish taco to me. That fish has got to be deep fried. But that's why I go out for those fish tacos. If I'm doing fish tacos at home, I'll do this crunchy treatment, but I still will do the slaw. I'll do some hot sauce. Some of my kids like the hot stuff. Some of them don't. You know, I'll just throw together fish tacos and that's always really, really popular. But the other thing that people don't think about is fish with pasta. Like that's a thing and it's delicious.
Yeah, totally. I love it. Love it.
Yeah. So Carla Hall, with whom I read a few books, you know, she introduced me to a Southern soul food dish that's essentially like fish with tomato sauced spaghetti. And I promise you, every kid in the world would love that. So the fish you can for sure do like a cornmeal fried fish, but any fillet of fish with spaghetti, break it up in there, mix it up. It's really, really tasty. And the other fish dish that has been a staple for my kids for so, so many years is salmon teriyaki.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is, for me, as you know, busy mom, like start to finish 20 minutes, but they love that sauce.
Yeah.
Right? They just love. And teriyaki sauce is really just three ingredients. Mine is sake, mirin, and soy. That's it.
Yeah.
So I just mix.
And what's the ratio?
I do two parts sake and mirin to one part soy.
Okay.
So like quarter cup, two tablespoons. Or if you're making a really big batch. Well, no, that's a big batch.
Yeah, yeah.
Two tablespoons,
yeah.
Two tablespoons to one. I just, you know, sear the salmon in a pan, take the salmon out, throw the sauce right into the same pan until it thickens a bit and you see it, you know, bubbles and thickens for a few minutes, pour it over the fish and dinner is done. And that's just a flavor profile, you know, salty, sweet fish.
Yeah, and like some rice and maybe some pickles.
That's
or
right.
Some salad.
Oh, for sure. Rice, and then I just do a really quick sort of smashed cucumber salad, and that's dinner.
Oh, that's great. Cool. I want to go to another question because I think this is a really big one for that sort of keeps people away from cooking fish. So I want to go to Teresa.
Hi, I'm calling from Austria. I really, really love fish and seafood in every kind of way, but it always smells so bad in the kitchen after cooking it.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried so many things, but nothing really helps. Please give me a tip and help me. Anyway, love your podcast. Best wishes from Austria. Bye.
Well, thank you for listening, Teresa. So this is, I think, a huge one for people because, you know, people say, like, I don't want to smell like fish for 3 days. And I feel them on it because I don't either. I think a lot of the smell comes from high heat cooking, mm-hmm. because what the high heat does is it changes the chemistry of the fat in the fish, right? And then mm-hmm. and plus, like, the high heat is like kind of spraying it all over your, like, you know, sort of micro misting it all over your kitchen. And what's your approach?
What I tend to not do is I tend to not do what I learned to do in restaurant kitchens, right? Which is to get that fish into a crazy hot pan, right? Because it does do exactly what you said, right? All the fat immediately changes and it gives you that fried fish smell that you do not want in your house or in your hair or in your clothes. I started over a gentler heat, and then, especially because salmon is so fatty, by the time the fish is cooked through, I like to start it skin side down because I like that crunchy skin. And by the time it's done, it will be crunchy and seared, but actually the kitchen won't smell that much because you didn't have that really intense sort of hitting the hot pan, the fish hitting the hot pan. That being said, I for sure have the hood on and I for sure keep the windows open. But the way I tend to think of it is exactly that. Like, if I want a really perfectly seared piece of fish, well, I should say post-pandemic, I will go to a restaurant for that. I guess I have not had fish like that in a while. But yes, when you slip it into a stew or you're poaching it or it's going into liquid, you don't have that smell. I do love a crunchy fish, and that's why I will do it under the broiler or in the oven, because again, when it's being coated by something else, but also that sort of surrounding heat, that sort of even heat of the oven or even of the broiler, that's not going to cause that sort of smell. One thing that I really encourage people to do, especially because it is getting warmer, is to go outside and grill fish. So that's something I really think is fun too. And I know that, you know, this is the sort of thing we started out by talking about buying whole fish and how most people can't or don't. But I do think that summer is a fun time to pick one up because you can throw that on the grill really easily. But any fish actually can go on the grill too. You can put it in a foil packet if you don't want to worry about having the fish stick to the grill. And you can do the same thing in the oven too. You can for sure do, and I just say foil packets because parchment paper can be a bit fussy to try to, you know, do some origami to fold it into a perfect little pouch that's sealed all the way around. But that's, you know, basically cooking a fish in a pouch in the oven is a surefire way to make sure your kitchen mainly smells like all the deliciousness and not the fishiness.
Yeah, totally. Actually, I want you to hold this thought because you mentioned grilling and we have a caller.
Hi, this is Constance calling from Frankfort, Kentucky. My question is, what about barbecue with seafood? I'm thinking swordfish, shrimp. What do you think?
Okay, so she's from Kentucky. So I don't know when she says barbecue, if she means it in like the East Coast way, which is basically just grilling, or if she means it in the legit way. because I think in Kentucky barbecue is sometimes lamb or mutton. So I don't know exactly which, if she's thinking smoking, slow smoking, or if she's thinking grilling, but because you love to grill. I don't know, what do you think? If you were to say, are there types of seafood that you think work better on the grill or better for smoking? Like, what do you think?
Sure. I think generally fish that you, or seafood in general that you want on the grill, you want ones that aren't really delicately textured, right? So, you know, this isn't a place where you want like a thin, lovely flavor. Dover sole, either smoked or grilled, or flounder, or anything that you know falls apart easily once it's cooked is not something that's going to do great in the grill. Unless you're putting it into a packet, in which case you can for sure put it in a packet and get a bit of that smokiness in there. But fatty fish are really delicious in the grill. I think most people already know this, right, about salmon. And salmon is one of those things where it is conducive to both high heat grilling as well as smoking. Obviously, since we all have smoked salmon, you can, if you are an adventurous cook, for sure try cold smoking, hot smoking. But any sort of fatty fish like that, swordfish is great because they do come in these thick, hearty steaks and their texture really holds up well. I prefer to do swordfish, sort of direct grilling over relatively high heat, because what you need to have happen with any grilling protein, but especially with fish, is that you need the proteins to tighten enough, right? And you need to create the char, where the fish will release by itself from the grate. You don't ever want to be trying to scrape it off and have it fall apart into a million pieces. And you also don't want to dry it out and have it overcook. So if you're working with fish, you either basically need to go high heat to create that sear, or you need to go low indirect heat to smoke it. You know, for smoking, I have smoked Arctic char as well, and just other things that have enough fat to be able to withstand that sort of low, slow heat and still stay really flavorful and juicy. But shrimp, I tend to go high heat, just quick, you know, getting a nice char in that. If you have barbecue sauce, slathering that on so that it caramelizes with that as well. But squid, same thing. You want it to go just over really high heat, really fast to give it a nice quick char. But yeah, seafood on the grill is great. You just got to make sure your fire's hot. I think is a lot of times what I see, you know, when fish sticks or when shrimp just sort of are cooked, but they're not nice and charred, it's usually just because the fire's not hot enough.
Yeah. And it's not just the fire, but like the actual grates of the grill.
Yep.
You know, if you're doing gas, close the cover. So you're actually heating the metal of the grates. Mm-hmm, it's like heating your pan.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm also, I'm a big believer in, I pretty generously oil the fish and seafood itself. Make sure it's really evenly and well coated with oil right before it goes on the grill.
Yeah. And don't mess with it, right? Just let it cook. Like, let it sear before you get nervous and start trying to flip it. And then it's, because at first it sticks and then it releases.
Exactly. Yeah.
You mentioned squid on the grill, which I do love, and we actually have a question from Boston about squid, too.
Hello, I'm Mary, and I have a question about squid tubes. I keep seeing them at the fish counter of my local store, and they look very exciting. I've bought them once, chopped them up, and put them in the fish tube, and they were delicious. But I'm curious, what else can you do, especially with the whole tube? Maybe you could stuff it, but I'm not sure with what. What do you think?
Okay, you have a whole pile of squid tubes in front of you. What are you going
to
do?
Squid tubes are great. Well, squid tubes and tentacles. I have to say, if you see those tentacles, make sure you get those too, because I love the tentacles. And both are sold frozen. And I actually often will keep those in the freezer too, because they thaw out beautifully. And I think for me, the rule of thumb that I follow with squid is I either want it to cook really, really fast or really, really slow. Anything in between, and you're going to get really chewy squid. You're going to get this sort of texture where you're just, where you're chewing
it's
forever.
Like rubber bands.
Exactly. So either like just quick turn on the grill, or I often will poach it, right? So water really, really boiling hard, salt the water, toss it in, drain it right away, like within a minute, right? Go ahead and drain it. And then I usually like to, I'm already thinking about summer and warm weather, right? That makes a great chilled seafood salad. You know, that's something you can sort of toss with greens or with any other vegetables. But in terms of going low and slow and you have whole tubes, she's absolutely right. Stuffing them is a really great way to go. I love all the different Spanish versions of this. So like stuffing them with, you know, with some sort of breadcrumby, chorizo-y mixture. And then simmering them for a pretty long time in a tomato-y sauce.
Yeah.
So you want to simmer them until that squid is tender, is delicious and tender. And, you know, what she did is super smart. You can cut it into rings or chop it up, throw it into a stew, and you just want to let it simmer. So if you're doing a big seafood stew, right, often, as we were talking about earlier, any sort of kimchi-based stew, squid I will often throw in earlier than the shrimp and the fish, which can go on towards the end. Just toss it in there and let it go.
And people should eat more squid because it's actually like one of the more sustainable fish, and it's good. I think, you know, people think you can only fry it. That's just not true. It's great every which way.
Yeah.
All right, Genevieve, this has been so fun. I love talking to you.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
Until next time, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks so much, Francis.
Genevieve Coe is senior editor for New York Times Cooking and is also the author of a great book. It's not about fish, but it's about more nutritious baking called Better Baking. And over at our website, splendidtable.org, you will find a collection of terrific fish and seafood recipes. That's our show for the week. We hope you enjoyed it. And remember, if you ever have any cooking questions for us, record them as voice memos on your phone and email them to contact@splendidtable.org. We'll talk to you next week. ABM Studios are run by Lily Kim, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetta Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jenny Lupke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.